All right. Now, this is a very difficult talk for the same reason the talk was difficult last night. It is new lines of thought that are developed, and they're not especially well organized. And on top of that, even more than last night, I open up new doors for myself. And it is exceedingly frustrating to open something up and not be able to go into it. So there's going to be a lot of that. So be prepared for a night of frustration. All right. What we're trying to do in all these talks is we're trying to provide a simple review and understanding of cause and consequence. And we're finding that it's not so simple after all. And that might be because of my nature. I can't even open a matchbook without thinking about the cosmic implications of it. And I can belabor anything to the point that it becomes difficult. Now, along the way, we're coming up with all sorts of questions. In fact, tomorrow night we're going to have a quiz. But being a prima donna, I'm going to ask the questions and give the answers in the quiz. It'll be that kind of a thing. Now, all of the things that we open up, especially in this talk, could be the subject of quite a few talks beyond it. So it's going to be difficult. For a few minutes, let's begin looking at a family of questions on one facet of the principle that opens up a lot of things for mystical aspirants. Now, we've noted in the past that the principle of cause and consequence begins to separate or individuate and awaken selfhood. There, in fact, may even be a para principle to that in some realm of pure spirit. That's one of those speculative doors that will just leave ajar. It seems that in terms of the evolutionary creation, as found by mystery students of all of the different mysteries, that there are important times when a multiple of factors comes into play in our evolution. Many things are initiated all at the same time. It's sort of like you throw a stone in the water and the splash goes in all directions and the rings spread out in all directions. And there seem to be splash moments where there is a convergence or a separation in many different directions. For example, in our human evolution, at the same time that there was the separation of the sexes physically into male and female bodies so that we could divide the creative energy between procreation and development of inner organs for the perception and understanding. Well, at that same time, there was also a separation in our soul nature between the children of fire and the children of water, the children of Cain and the children of Seth. That is, those with a Freemasonic temperament and those with a Catholic temperament. So this is something that happened at the same time. Now, when we're talking about a moment in time like that, we're talking about a moment that can be very large, thousands of years, or some cases, millions of years. We're trying to talk about the concept of a moment. And what a moment is, it's different than an instant. The moment is going to come up several times during the course of this talk. Now, as the self was being awakened, as we turned the creative energy inward and built the brain so that the mind could interpenetrate and that the spirit could work through the mind into the body, at that moment in time, there was an awakening to the principle of cause and consequence. We mentioned earlier that the religions of the Holy Ghost, the Jehovistic religions, were for the purpose of individuation, for each of us to become a separate self, a unique vantage point of the universal spirit, both in creative expression and in recording the incidents in the external creation. Now, the religions of the Holy Ghost came into ascendancy during the Atlantean epoch of time. At the beginning of the Atlantean epoch, we were pretty much all one mass unified humanity. And we were that in Lemurian epoch in those times. But we had to be broken into races, and then clans, and then families, and then individuals. And so that was the work of the religions of the Holy Spirit. Now, after the sexes of the dense physical body were separated, since then we have been reborn alternately. Usually there are no special laws about rebirth, but we're usually reborn alternately in male and female bodies. And the reason for this is that we can get a viewpoint of things from two points of view. Usually, rebirths happen on the order of anywhere between 750 and 1250 years, varying from individual to individual. If you've done a lot of creative work and you've done your spiritual exercises so that you can hold an imagination and a thought in your consciousness for a long time, you can come back to birth more quickly, unless you have something very, very special to do, and then it takes a long time. But I don't want to get into all of that because it's another thing that gets way too long. But as we were born, we were born into male and female bodies for differing experiences. And the creative energy, as we just said, was divided between procreation and for building inner organs for consciousness in the physical body. Now, when we were reborn in female bodies, we did a lot of work with physical bodybuilding, just as women, when they're gestating, do in our times. That the imaginative faculty that is more active in women is used. It is used for building new children coming to birth, building the bodies for them. Also, we developed a lot of receptivity and sensitivity to nature. In the male bodies, we did feats of activity, feats of strength, projections of energy, and our consciousness was not so cyclical as it was linear. In general, the feminine life is round not only in body, it is circular in experience. I remember one time I was going to marry a woman, and I went to live with her, and she had two children, and every day there were all of these things that had to be taken care of for the kids, to be cleaned and fed and off to school and all of that, and it was a very circular existence. And I had been a bachelor for a good number of years, and I was used to, you know, leaving like a shot in the morning in a masculine way, accomplishing things. And it was a shock to me what that was like, because at the same time that everything was circular and it seemed like nothing was done, within those cycles, everything was being done, like the character of the children was being molded. And that was really quite an experience for me. So in the female body, we had a more circular type of life, and in the male body, we had a more linear type of life. And in this time, during this whole revolution of the Earth period, our dense physical bodies were being regenerated. In spiritual things work from the inside out. It's not like in building where you add another addition on. If you want to do something different, like having a brain and nervous system, you go all the way back to the beginning and you come forward with a whole new physical body and a whole new vital body that accommodate within themselves the ability to have a nervous system. And so in this way, when we were recapitulating the dense physical body, we were preparing for an awareness of the outer world. Previously, our consciousness was primarily inward. It was more like animals. When we met somebody, we knew what their soul characteristics were, and we knew whether they were friend or foe, or whether they would be beneficial or inimical to our being. And so we were becoming outward. Now, from this we can see that the dense physical body was meant to have a brain, and that brain was interpenetrated by an etheric brain, and that was in turn interpenetrated by the mind through the desire body. So we're talking about thought being the gateway of the spirit into this world. That was before we had evolved the soul body and we could get direct intuitions. We're talking about a very long, slow process. Now, we're told at that time that we did things to each other that right now would be considered horribly cruel. The only things that we have like it now are those destructive sports, like boxing, where the only way you can win is by harming someone, not by reaching a goal or something like that, but the more harm you can do, the more you win. And we used to do things like roasting each other on spits and cutting each other and things like that. And people were brave for the amount of pain that they could experience. Whatever was painful was good, because pain awakened us to the external world, and it removed us from the atavistic and involuntary clairvoyance that had been our mainstay in the past, and it began to open us up to external reality, which was necessary as we were coming deeper into matter and passing through back into the spiritual world. Now, as we awoke then to separate existence, if you're in pain, pain is a very lonely place, and you know that you are the one that is feeling the pain, and that was one of the big things for individuating. So as we awoke in our individuality, our religion and our values changed correspondingly. Now, I know that to some of you that this sounds totally preposterous. If it is not agreeable to you, just consider it a fairy tale. It's all right. As long as we get to the ideas and the ideas take in our consciousness, or we can find them in our own consciousness and live accordingly. Eventually, as the nervous system developed, the memory of pain came to supplant the pain itself. Whatever produced a memory. We still find vestiges of that deep in the Old Testament when people lived very long lives in the images of their descendants. Methuselah didn't live 900 years of these kinds of years. The pictures of Methuselah's life lived in the etheric pictures in the bloodstream of his descendants for that long of a time. So memory became very, very important. We developed memory before we developed logic. We developed one pole, the negative pole of the reflecting ether, before we developed the positive pole. It's analogous to the way in a childhood we developed the negative pole of the chemical ether, which is elimination, like a little baby is nothing but shit and snot and all of that. It's all elimination before we develop the positive pole, and then there can be the rapid growth and all of the things that take place afterwards. Now, eventually, of a memory of one sensory experience, usually painful, came to be related to another sensory experience. And gradually, we began through memory to make connections between one experience and another. And through this connection, we eventually began to wake up the capacity to think. We could see that this action was associated with this action, or this sensation was associated with this sensation. We began to have through logic, a continuity of consciousness between one event and another. And this became a logical connection. And this was the beginning of thinking. And with the beginning of thinking, we became aware that we who were doing the thinking, and especially we who were the beings that were experiencing both cause and consequence, were individuals. We became aware of ourselves through what we were experiencing, and especially through what we were thinking. So with the beginning of thinking in terms of cause and consequence, we became aware of the thinker, which is the self. And this is another way that we see that the principle of cause and consequence and the logical connection between the principle of cause and consequence is responsible for individuation in us. So our thinking, since we were still pure and innocent and had not gone as deeply into materialism and had not carried our sinful nature to its logical conclusion whereby we could see that it was stupid, we still had a lot of creative force. And with this creative force, our ability to condense thoughts actually condensed the atmosphere of the earth. For that reason, we were responsible for the precipitation of the fog that used to cover, it was almost as thick as liquid, that used to surround the earth. It's still spoken of in mythologies in all different parts of the world. And so precipitation of thought had the effect, because we're part of the creative hierarchies, it had the effect of precipitating the atmosphere within which we live. And we became creators. And in this same process, the alternating of consciousness between thought and memory and thinking on things that we could experience, that we had experienced before, that we had memories of, including other thoughts, that alternation back and forth between thought and memory helped us internally to develop the lungs. We're talking about an exceedingly slow process, but the evolution of mind and the evolution of lungs and the evolution of the atmosphere of the earth being completely clear are all tied together. And they're all tied together, as we know, by Gemini. Gemini rules the airy atmosphere, it rules the lungs, it rules the principle of alternating consciousness between two poles, a receptive pole of memory and a projective pole of concrete thought. So we can see that, you know, we're participating. We are in the evolution. We are really movers. Now, contemporaneous with all of this, there was individuation, and the religion of the law came to be the religion. And another very important thing happened at the same time. And that was when we passed back and forth between cause and consequence, and when we began to be focused more into this external particular digital world, there was an awareness of time. A very, very big change in consciousness. In the realms of pure spirit, there is no time as we know it. Not even in the sense of logical concatenation of ideas. Because there's no differentiation in the spirit, not even into concepts. So in spirit, there is eternity, and eternity is a much different conception of the experience of being than time is. So the more we became aware of cause and consequence, the more we became aware of time. There are two parts of a unity. One, time is the potential in which causes and consequences are perceived. precipitated. But that hasn't really fully dawned on the consciousness of most people even to this day. Now, the change from a cause to a consequence is a change in consciousness. Just as there is a change in consciousness in our body between when we're in-breathing and out-breathing. When we're in-breathing, we have oxygenated blood, and that affects our thinking process differently than our consciousness on the out-breath. The thing that we're trying to get at, there are a lot of exciting things in here we could go into, but the thing that we're trying to get at is that the change from cause to consequence is irreversible. Now, time as a commodity is understood by physics, and some of its formulae is reversible. But that's because it's an abstract world, and it is not a world of experience. In life, and in the consciousness of life, once a cause has become a consequence, everything is changed, especially our consciousness is changed. And the effects of that change are irreversible. To think otherwise is nothing but fantasy. It's escapism. Eventually in these talks, we'll talk about grace and forgiveness, which is not the same thing as the reversing of cause and consequence. But for right now, it's best to follow our course that we're taking right now. Suppose you had never experienced love. Suppose you've never been in love with someone. And then you fall in love with someone. The consequence of that cannot be changed. You can never go back to a world where you were innocent like a child and you had never fallen in love. If you had never heard music, if you had been deaf or something like that and not known music, and then suddenly you hear music, and the wonderful thing that it is, you can't go back. You're changed, and you're changed forever. You can't say there is no such thing as music, or the world is just as good without music. Now, it isn't always as simple and straightforward as that in life, and it is in that example, but with regard to cause and consequence, it's a one-way street. Cause and consequence as manifest in time is a one-way street. Once this is understood, the questions that we ask about time and the questions that we ask about cause and consequence are very different. And our whole outlook on time is very different. And all kinds of questions come up. They're not easy questions to understand because time and concepts about time are two very different things. We can understand some of the concepts of time, but the experience of time itself as itself is very difficult to experience. Time is so subtle and it's so encompassing that there are several quite different concepts about what time is that work quite well. And they're not mutually exclusive. They are compatible with each other. Now, in an earlier talk, we spoke about cause and consequence being more like action and reaction in science than they are like cause and effect. So let's use that as a starting point as we try to understand time. According to the principle of action and reaction, every time we take a step, whether we realize it or not, the earth moves back a little bit. There is a reaction to the action that we initiate to move forward. It's imperceptible, but you can demonstrate that in a much different way. Suppose you're standing on the prow of a rowboat, and everybody has had this experience. You're standing on the prow of the rowboat and you want to step off onto the land. When you're a little kid, you learn that. because you often end up in the water instead of on the land, because the boat has less mass and there's less friction in the water, and when you push off to step forward, the reaction is that the boat moves back and you don't go as far forward as you intended to do, and you end up in the drink. There's enough friction so that there is a purchase of action or a purchase of distance that you hit the water just before where you would have hit on land. So there, it's not a completely frictionless system. Now this is a good example in several ways. It's a good to show cause and consequence. It's good to show action and reaction. And it shows that the source of cause and consequence are actually within the causal agent. There isn't something outside that made the boat go backwards or that made you go forward. It comes from within. Now, we can't complain that the forces of nature are energies or that the world has conspired against us. It's a good example in that way because it shows the neutrality of cause and consequence. We're responsible for where we land. It isn't like that there's some god of destiny that laughed because a trick was played on us and we ended up in the water. It is in this that it appears that the consequences come toward us and that we push the past back both at the same time. So we have the notion that the future is rushing toward us at the same time that the past is going away from us. Also very good for understanding the nature of cause and consequence, because in the future, that is where the consequence comes from, or it seems to come from. And I don't want to be too definitive about this because that takes away the subtlety of the circumstance, but it seems that that comes rushing toward us from the future. So it's not clear whether we're pushing toward the future or the future is pushing toward us. Now, when we learn by a simple experience like this that I think probably everyone has had, we learn about the principles of physics. We learn about resistance and its importance, because it's paradoxical, but if you think about it, if there were no resistance, there would probably be no forward progress, because you'd have nothing to get a purchase of advantage, of mechanical advantage to. You see it in Wile E. Coyote cartoons. He goes off the end of the cliff, and he's running, and he's trying to swim, but he can't get anything, and pretty soon he goes plopping down, and then the anvil usually falls on top of him from above. You know, cartoons are terribly cruel things, but that's one of the reasons they're funny, because all these terrible things are done and nobody really gets hurt. All right. If we would look at the converse of this, which is interesting, it would say then something that seems almost impossible, but it's worthy of our consideration, and that would be that we make the greatest progress when there is the greatest resistance. And looking at circumstances in my own life in terms of making spiritual and moral progress, I have to say that that's true. I even at one time learned to play cards by playing with people who were much better than me, and having that kind of resistance cost me a lot of money to begin with, but by the end I was taking money home. That's a very simple example of when you have resistance, when you're playing with the big kids, you grow up a little more, you grow much faster. Now, this almost seems impossible, because if there were infinite resistance, there would be no progress. And there are some people that are of that philosophy too, but that's another one of those tantalizing things that we can't go into. Cosmically, this kind of thinking raises all kinds of problems that one just loves to dig into. One of the first questions that comes up is expanding it to the macrocosm. Where is God's resistance for God's progress? We tend to think of resistance as something external. And in the divine, the resistance is external. And the most subtle resistance is resistlessness. The greatest resistance in the macrocosmic cosmos is in what is called cosmic root substance. It is where everything is in potential of becoming a form, but everything is undifferentiated points that have only position. The concept that mathematicians have was derived from spiritual philosophy, where it is a real experience. Cosmic root substance. And its resistance is by having no resistance. It's easy to carry a person if they get stiff like a plank, but if they just get very limp and flop and they offer no resistance, it's very hard, much harder to carry them. But that's all aside here. I don't want to get too much into that. It works as conscious assertion raises a silhouette of resistance from the unconscious part of its own being within the absolute. And so what we're talking about is that there is an unknown even for the Supreme Being, and when it asserts itself, the light of its being, it realizes that there is also a darkness, that there are things that it does not know. And the relationship of the known to the unknown is that relationship of the assertion of light versus the resistance of darkness. That's a really oversimplification, and that puts us very far afield, so we have to get back on topic, and so we want to talk to something more relevant. When we are looking back and forth between action and reaction, we're looking in a linear way, because there are only, so to speak, two points of reference. The consequential point of reference, which is like the future, and the causal, which is like the past. Now, most people conceive of time as being linear. It's like a highway that proceeds from the past through the present and straight into the future. Of course, we have seen that there is an opposite highway running the opposite direction that is consequential, but that is something also that we don't have time to go into. So in this outlook, linear outlook of time, we say we build on the past. And that's a valid thing to do, because the past is extremely objective, because it is factual, because past consequences have brought about a history, and that history is as indubitable as knowing love after the first time you've been in love. So we live our whole lives in this linear kind of fashion. We may go to run errands, and first we go to the pet store, and then we go to the grocery store, and then we run some other errand, and then we come home. We have our individual timelines, and we have the general timeline that we call history, that is moving forward, but it's moving forward in a dimension that we don't really know. It's not the dimension of the planet going in its orbit. It is the dimension of the future, or the dimension of potential. Now, how do we explain things in the future? that do not seem to be the product of us either consciously or unconsciously. It would seem that the future holds things that come into being, and a lot of them are unexplainable. They're unknown. If cause and consequence is true, what about all those things that we didn't seem to cause? Materialistic science is sort of schizophrenic about questions like this. On one hand, it says everything is determined, and there are laws of nature that are irrevocable, and when we know them well enough, everything will be predictable. But when they get in a pinch and there are things that they can't explain, or there are things that are too difficult, they place everything in the realm of randomness. Now, if you think about it, randomness and logic are not bed partners, because you never know whether what seems to be logical might just be a random event, some kind of quirk of destiny that it seems like it's logical. Either it's logical or it is not logical. Again, this is a subject that if we could go into the metaphysical aspects of it, it becomes extremely... I'm not trying to tantalize you with all these things. I'm trying to invite you to get into this kind of thinking. There are a lot of things out there to do, and it gets you off the streets, and it's much cheaper than cable TV, you know. So reason and randomness don't work together. Now, we are, again, way out of bounds, and we've gotten into something that goes way beyond cause and consequence and the sort of things like that. We want to understand the unknown to the known through the mind. Let's take an example from astrology. This is an indication that we're wanting a lot in terms of what is really important. We know the constellations and the signs and the fixed stars and the planets and the aspects. We know they're focusing agents for destiny on a cosmic scale. They are what's happening sort of like in the organism of the macrocosm. And from looking at many individuals who have been born or reborn into the physical manifestations of that grand scheme of activity that is registered astrologically, astronomically, we know what results when these planets are this way or those planets are that way. We have had for, according to Madame Blavatsky, something like 1.5 million years, we've had an astrology that is basically like what we know now. But the more we practice astrology and the more people who are doing it, looking at more factors, we see there are many more factors than just the planets and things like that. But even with all the refinements that have come through astrology, there are major unknowns that are not shown astrologically. For example, something that has happened in the past. A big meteor could strike the Earth, and it could change civilization and the direction of evolutionary flow quite significantly. And there's nothing that I know of, or that I've even heard speculated of, that could indicate how astrology could tell us that unknown kind of thing, like a meteor coming to hit the Earth. So what I'm trying to say is that we need to expand, and we need something more than astrology, which is kind of provincial. It's kind of parochial, and it helps us learn in a smaller way, but we need a larger knowledge. We need a more total knowledge that encompasses both past and future. Now, people who have faith sense things like this, and they sense that it's all good, for it is all for the good. And as reasonable people, when we have no knowledge, We are honest and we live in faith that the things that are going to happen are happening for a purpose, that there are causes other than the causes that we initiate, and that we participate in some kind of cosmic destiny that precipitates things like meteors and things like that, even though we don't have a knowledge of being able to understand those things. I'm trying to say that just because we're trying to, with our minds in a puny sort of way, understand cause and consequence, doesn't mean that it isn't important for us to have a great spiritual faith, because that spiritual faith is at least as important as our minds in determining our future directions. If nothing else, it teaches us that we need to be aware and ready for anything. It's like the famous statement from Hamlet, the readiness is the all. And that's the thing for modern people. All right, now we have to get back to the topic again. You can see what happens. As I'm developing these notes, I'm experiencing things, and I'm following them far away, and then I have to come back because I realize that the epicycles are going on to other epicycles and taking me away. So these are some of the problems of linear time. Now, some of these problems of unknowns that come into our existence can actually be explained in a linear way, and it is valid. It is because some things take a much longer time to come to fruition. Some causes take a longer time to become consequences. I know this because I have a garden. And this year, in my garden, I'll have two crops of fast cabbage before the slow cabbage comes to ripeness. So the fast cabbage is like an ephemeral cause, something that you put it out there and very quickly the consequence comes back. And some things you can put out there and they take an exceedingly long time to come to ripeness, so long that you no longer remember the cause by the time the consequence is manifest. That's really important because you're facing the experience as it is. It's a really valid kind of way of looking at destiny. In general, the deeper our causes are, the deeper the level that they come from, the longer it takes for them to materialize as consequences. This is ironic because thought seems to be so fast. But for thought to come to full materialization, rather than just a simple reaction, takes an enormous amount of time. If we think about it, the Greeks were the first to shave their beards. They shaved their beards so that they couldn't be grabbed in warfare, because warfare was hand to hand, and everybody, you were directly in front of your opponent. Now, instead of being direct mano a mano, we flip ICBMs, and it takes them about 15 minutes before they land. That's a matter of consequences at a distance in time and a distance in space. And so they give a good example of things that we are dealing with. Similarly, we may encounter something in our linear time that is not the result of an immediate cause. And it really is a consequence of something that we have put into place before. However, some things are better understood with a different conception of time than the linear conception of time. The linear time doesn't have to be bad, but some things are explained better in another way. Besides, linearity is only two-dimensional. It only goes forward and back. And we are at least three-dimensional people with our consciousness now and capable of more different dimensions. So we have to look at a different kind of time. And as you can see, this talk is going to be truncated because we're never going to get up to all the things that one would want to get to, so we're just going to cut off short. Another concept of time that works is circular time, or cyclicity. And this explains a lot of things. More of our experience in life is cyclical than linear. We have hundreds and hundreds of cycles in our bodies, some of which take a number of years to be completed. And something like the Krebs cycle take place something like 10,000 times per second. And we're very busy people. Even when we're just sitting here internally, we're extremely busy. We're doing a lot of work. Now, linear time is not antithetical to cyclical time, because if you're going around the cycle, you're still going forward like as though in a line, but the linear time doesn't explain and it doesn't give you the values or the moods that you get of circular time. A cycle has stages within it, and those different stages of the cycle have different moods or different qualities. Multifarious the number of cycles that there are. Now, a materialist would say, well, these are just romanticizations of natural phenomena that can be explained by the angle of incidence of sunlight at the different seasons of the year, and that would be perfectly true. But that's all the material scientist sees. He doesn't see the great work of creation. I just sense a bunch of people, one of the best PowerPoints I've ever seen in my life of trees. And you really understand a concept of relating to light and wind and earth in trees when you look at that presentation. It's absolutely beautiful. In a way, the relationship of cyclicity as understood by material science versus cyclicity as it is understood by us spiritually is similar to a landscape and its relation to nature. A landscape portrays all of the shapes and the colors and even many of the relationships of the different things in the landscape. They're the essential things. You look at a landscape, you look out the window, and that's what it is. It can even show the distances and things like that you can see with vision. But a two-dimensional painting can never represent the living, multi-dimensional reality of nature. It's almost always a brief abbreviation, and it's dead at that. It's just blobs of paint. You look really close up at a painting, that's all it is blobs of paint. Whereas even the smallest bit of nature that is in the landscape is alive. So the materialist is looking at the blobs of paint and is looking at the landscape, and it can reproduce that, but not the life, just as Rod said in his talk this afternoon. It's possible to superimpose romance onto nature. Poets do it all the time. And it enhances our understanding because it's been humanized in a way that our human understanding can understand it. But that doesn't mean that nature isn't suffused with an immeasurable amount of living content. Content that can be experienced with sufficient sensitivity. Without going into too much detail and description, the truth of the matter is that we live within something like a kaleidoscope of many cycles taking place at the same time. One moment is different from another, but there may be a mood of the people that lasts 30 or 40 years in some states of looking at things or experiencing things last millions of years. So there is cyclical time. Phenomenal and concrete manifestation is cyclical as well as linear. And the progress is then seen in a spiral sense. So there is a resolution between linear cause and consequence and cyclical cause and consequence. If we take a causal moment, such as a thought or an emotion or a vital action or a kinetic action, it is a whole. And that moment can be conceived of as a cycle. A cycle is a whole, and it contains everything that is in it. It is that moment, which is the same kind of a moment that is the moment that defines the relationship of cause and consequence. It's very much like what we had in Elizabeth's talk yesterday. An octave has all of the notes within the scale, within the octave. And a cycle has everything that is within it as a moment. Sometimes historians codicalize a year, like saying this was the year 1954, and you have all of the things that occurred in that. Now, our image is stepping forward and causing a minimal change in the Earth by moving it backward is descriptively more accurate than trying to step out of an unsecured boat. A causal moment, no matter what its scope, is a whole, and a whole that is revolutionary. It's cyclical, it's spinning, or however one wishes to describe it. So on the fundamental level, the most fundamental levels of being express themselves as cycles within ourselves. Now in the Rosicrucian cosmic conception, it is described that the three attributes of spirit are will for the first attribute, love, wisdom for the second attribute, and activity for the third. On the highest level, on the level of the Supreme Being, it is power, word, and motion. And it's very close, and it's very clear that the motion is spinning. Spinning, a change that is both local to the individual, that is changing within itself in the spinning, and changing in relation to the external world outside of it. That third member that is the spinner is the thinker. And so once more we come back to that principle that the thinker and the spinner that does the change of cause and consequence are all tied together. When we're talking about a moment or a specific manifestation, whether that is a causal moment or whether that is an entire creation where things are set spinning, that finalization that comes through action, that there is a cause and consequence that causes a change in consciousness so that everything, including the Supreme Being, is changed forever and moving forward, is all dependent on that same focus that is the source of the understanding that is cause and consequence. So time, even though it may be very artificial, and though it may be understood linearly or cyclically or spirally, time is an important thing, and it isn't just a way to regulate we humans who are blinded and trapped in materialism. It is very functional to the change of consciousness within the spirit itself. The transcendent spirit does not need the concrete manifestations. It is what it is, and it will always be that. But in another way, it does need the concrete manifestations, because in new creation, in the working into the absolute, in the unknown, through the process of time, and through the process of cause and consequence, even the Supreme Being is becoming. Excuse me. So this takes us out of the limits of digital materialism. And it brings us into the spirit where things are continuous. But even in the spirit, everything is done in the moment. If we have an intuitive experience, which is how we understand what cause and consequence means, the understanding comes from the spirit, even though the phenomena and the experiences are found in matter. When we have that moment of intuition, if we can enter into that moment and penetrate it deeply, we are taken right into the universal spirit itself. So what we're talking about, any moment and every moment, is for the universal spirit, it is a moment of enlightenment. And if we are astute in ourselves, any time we find ourselves in a causal situation, it becomes the same for us. Any time a cause becomes a consequence, in that moment when the whole is understood, is a moment that we can penetrate through and come to spiritual reality. If we realize that we're going through a cycle, such as the cycle of rebirth, which is central to the Rosicrucian philosophy, it is where we have a chance to process our past causes and understand our past consequences and rebuild anew from a point of view of not being an active, ongoing manifestation. If we come back to rebirth, we can understand the total of life as a cycle. It happens to me now a lot because I'm getting to be the age where I'm looking back as much as I looked forward, and I'm looking back with the consequences as they're going their direction, and who am I? Am I that child at birth? Am I the person that I was when I had my first thought on the side of Bascom Hill? Who am I? And you begin to understand that what you are and what your life is an entire moment. And you begin to understand why, through cause and consequence, living the life is what produces the waking up in moment by moments, in instant moments, to the great moment that is a life itself. And that's what we're trying to get at with cause and consequence. Now, the whole can be delineated, and we understand things that way because we're sort of at this point so ABC Darren, and we're so Darian and so crippled that we cannot understand whole moments. So we stretch things out and we delineate them. Our Rosicrucian temple service tells us that right now we know in part, but that eventually we will know as we are known. And it says literally, we will know in wholes and not in part. That is the way spiritual consciousness is. Until then, we get little moments of experience, and we get little moments in causes when causes become consequences. The more we ponder these things, the more we experience them, and the more we watch the process of experiencing causes becoming consequences and causes and consequences rushing toward each other, if we watch the process itself, the more we understand the whole of awakening to spiritual consciousness. And if we watch ourselves watching, we are able to transcend and put our consciousness into a God's eye point of view. So when we're looking at cause and consequence and awakening up individuality, we're looking at something that is very big and that takes us beyond what we ever considered. So even in the littlest things that we do in life, there is tremendous understanding. So tomorrow night we'll talk about a different things about cause and consequence. It will be a considerably different kind of talk. For now, let's close with the Rosicrucian students' prayer. O God, increase our love for Thee so that we may serve Thee better from day to day. Let the words of our mouths and the meditation of our hearts be acceptable in Thy sight, O Lord, our strength and our Redeemer. Are there any questions?
Sexuality, being born a male or female or yes. Whatever that division. I think I've read a lot about this, but I don't know from where. But for example, I feel like I'm a man and a woman. And
yes,
most
we
of the time,
all are. But
I know, but the predominant sexual feeling is yes. that I'm a man, but I'm in a woman's body. How does that come about?
We're going to talk about that tomorrow morning.
Oh,
we're have a fam-
I'll have to get up.
We're gonna have a famous case. We're gonna have a famous case of a first transsexual organ change person who stated exactly the same thing that you said right now, and we're gonna talk about that.
Can yeah. I add something to this?
Yes.
That's not.
Yes. Yes. But what we're saying that both sexes come out of one spiritual unity, and that in realms of particular manifestation where cause and consequence represent two sides of the manifestation, it is for our elementary education in life, so to speak, and for elementary function, it is found to be most efficient to manifest physically in one gender and at the same time internally in the other gender, and then by reversing we get the effect of the whole. And what you're talking about is something where something has been built up very strongly in past lives of the masculine quality, so that even now if it's in a feminine body, there is the feeling of masculinity despite the state of the body. And that's what we want to talk a little bit more about tomorrow. About what?
About lots of paint.
Yes. Yes, yes. What you're talking, yes. What you are talking about is the spiritualization of what is basically a mechanical problem by putting your intelligence, your consciousness into the composition, and you are raising the viewer from a mechanical perspective. You are superimposing a spiritual understanding, a romantic understanding, and you're making that available. If you look with the bland scientific point of view, you're just looking at the pixels as they appeared to the camera, but that's this is why our consciousness needs to change so much, because if you take a simple materialistic view, which almost all of us have, you say, how can somebody superimpose or in spiritual space bring a spiritual concept to something that is nothing but pixels in a machine? And that is the miracle of creation, and that's what we are doing. And in the arts there is more salvation for the future, because we're not limited by the mechanistic point of view. We see that there is something that goes beyond it, and that we can participate in it, and we can actually do that. And it's so good that we can agree over thousands of people that this is a good painting or that this is a good photo, because the intelligence of the creative intelligence of the artist who made it spreads through spiritual space, so to speak, and everybody can pick it up. And you say, ah, that person really knew what they were doing, and this is what they were telling and teaching us. Well, that edges you as an artist further forward, because you're set apart, and when you're set apart, that's one of the first steps toward initiation. You are forced to individuate because you can't fit in with the rest, and the rest, in their trying to force you back into conformity and into convention, that pressure put on you projects you even further into the realms of understanding. You're something about society that doesn't like people who are too different, because they want the conformity. But everything is an opportunity, because it's the same intelligence that is in every cause-consequence relationship. And I must say, I'm going to say some very strong things tomorrow morning when talking about this horoscope, and I do not want you to take personal offense. I'm not going to be personal about things. I'm going to talk about some attitudes that are not easy to take. Yeah. I'm not going to say anything anti-gay or anything transsexual. I'm going to talk about an attitude that some people have. What? Okay. All right. Any other questions? Yes. No, it's a different kind of learning. It's a more holistic kind of understanding. When you have one simple cause and one simple consequence, that's one thing. But when you see a moment and you see the whole cycle of it, you're seeing a much more total kind of thing. And with the cyclical view of time, you can understand things in a much greater, in a much more well-rounded way than you can in a linear conception of things. I don't know about that. I plead ignorance. Well, thank you very much.
Thanks.